Buying or selling your home? Real Estate for Life can connect you with a pro-life real estate agent. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 65% to Catholic Answers. Learn more at realestateforlife.org. Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Killett, your host. Very happy to be here to start the week and end the week on the same day for me, basically. What a crazy summer cold. Miserable summer cold. And I'm very grateful to Edgar and Thomas. It was you and Thomas, right, that covered for me while I was away? Well, thank you very much for doing that. I'm sorry to have been away. But what a great day to come back to. Ask Me Anything with Jimmy Akin. And that's a good opportunity. We haven't been doing as many Ask Me Anythings episodes. And so now is your opportunity to ask Jimmy whatever you like. If you've got a question for Jimmy Akin, just pick up the phone and call 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. I can tell you right now, just two lines open at this moment and they fill up quick. So go ahead and dial. Jimmy Akin is senior apologist here at Catholic Answers. Hello, Jimmy Akin. How you been?
Hello, Cyril Kellett. I've been doing okay. So, I'd ask how you've been doing, but you just told us all.
I know. It was not a fun week for me. But I got to get back as fast as I can when I tune in and Edgar and Thomas are doing a good job. My primary prayer when I get sick like that is that they'll do a terrible job. But they were doing a good job. So that got me better fast.
Okay, well, good deal.
888.
Glad you're back.
Thank you. 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. I told you Jimmy's senior apologist here, author of a whole bunch of books, including The Bible is a Catholic Book, and A Daily Defense, 365 Days Plus One to Becoming a Better Apologist. And he is the proprietor of two very fine podcasts a main action figure, a main player on several other podcasts, including this one. You can check out the Jimmy Akin podcast every Monday and The Mysterious World, Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, every Friday. So what dropped this morning, Jimmy, on Mysterious World?
On Mysterious World, we were playing part of an interview I did recently on another podcast called Glitch Bottle, which is devoted to ceremonial magic, which is not the same thing as stage magic. Ceremonial magic is people really trying to cast spells in the real world. And to do that, they use books known as grimoires, and they sometimes, there in the rituals they use, there are sometimes mentions of demons and angels and things like that. And so the listeners of Glitch Bottle decide, the host of Glitch Bottle and his listeners decided they wanted to have me on and ask me about Catholic perspectives on, what the church teaches about angels and demons and things, and what Catholics would make grimoires and things like that. So that's what we were covering today on the show.
Did you feel like you had a good conversation with those folks?
Oh yeah, it was a great conversation.
I'm very glad to hear it. I'm very glad to hear it.
Yeah, they were very respectful. They asked intelligent questions, and I was more than happy to share Catholic perspective with them.
Is this one of those Joe Rogan things where you just need to buckle up? You're going to do 6 hours of this or something like that, or how long do they go?
4 hours.
4 hours. I love this new medium.
We used 2 hours last week of the interview last week on Mysterious World, and 2 hours this week.
You know, I remember when I was young, there was all this concern about, oh, we're just becoming a soundbite culture. Nobody can stand more than a soundbite. It's funny how, as technology progresses, these things tend to work themselves out. If people want longer conversations, they'll find a way to have longer conversations.
Yep, absolutely. Technology is just a way of facilitating human desires, and so some humans are going to desire long-form content.
All right, I got a long-form question for you. Well, no, it's not that long-form, but people
it's
do
like
it.
It's like about 6 words.
The question itself is not long-form, but you have the opportunity to be as expansive as you like, as long as you can do it in under 8 minutes. So expand up to 8 minutes. How does the Vatican approve miracles? Savvy listeners want to know.
Well, the Vatican doesn't normally approve miracles except for one department. Now, there was a document that came out recently from the Dicastery for the Doctrine of the Faith that dealt with evaluating apparitions and other supernatural events. And this was guidance given primarily to local bishops. So if you're a local bishop and you have a report, let's say, of a Eucharistic miracle in your diocese, this document gives guidance for how to handle that kind of thing, although it's really almost exclusively focused on apparitions rather than on other supernatural events. Where miracles really get evaluated by the Vatican is at a different dicastery, the Dicastery for the Causes of Saints, because in order to be declared a saint, you typically need to have two verified miracles, one to get declared a beatus or a blessed, and then one to be canonized as a saint. And so that dicastery, for the causes of saints, that's the one that normally deals with miracles. And they do it in a staged process. So the process starts when someone from, you know, wherever in the world the miracle reportedly occurred, when that gets information gets forwarded to the advocate for the canonization of a particular saint, the advocate will then bring this report to the attention of the Dicastery for the Causes of Saints. And if it looks promising, they will then have these are typically medical miracles. They don't have to be medical miracles, but these days they almost always are. They will have a group of experts look into the facts of the case, just what happened and are there ways to explain this naturally and things like that. And they use, since these are almost always medical miracles, these tend to be medical experts. And so they have a body of them known as the Consulta Medica, or medical consultation, that looks into it. And they gather evidence, they present it to people who are specialists in the kind of medicine that was involved, and they give their opinion. And some of the experts they consult aren't even Catholic. They don't care if you're a medical expert what your faith is. They care how much of a medical expert are you. So, for example, and you may not even know you're being asked to consult on a miracle case. Some years ago, there was a Canadian blood pathologist named Jacqueline Duffin, who herself was an atheist, who got involved in a canonization-related miracle, and she didn't even know that's what she was doing. She, being a blood pathologist, they showed her sets of slides, before the miracle slides and after the miracle slides, and they didn't even mention the miracle. They just said, here are these two sets of slides. They're from the same patient. This blood disorder they had seems to have vanished. So is there any medical explanation for how that could happen? And Jacqueline Duffin said, oh, no. This is not medically possible. She thought that she was being asked to consult on a court case, like maybe someone switched up the slides in the lab, because there was no way this could happen. And then after she's given her opinion, she finds out this is a miracle case. And that piqued her curiosity. She was invited to go over to the Vatican for the canonization when it happened, and she did. And she got interested in how the church handles cases like this. So she did research at the Vatican archives, and she looked at like all of the case reports, all the miracle evaluations from the last, say, 500 years or so, and wrote a book about them called Medical Miracles. So you can get that book if you're interested in more details of the process. But basically, after the medical consultation has had its say, if they find something medically impossible happened, and by the way, there are certain criteria that they use for judging whether a reported miracle should even be considered. These criteria were pioneered by in the 1700s by a cardinal named Prospero Lambertini, who wrote a book. He worked basically at the equivalent of the Dicastery for the Causes of Saints, and he wrote a book, a four-volume book, on the canonization, on the beatification of and canonization of individuals. And he was later elected Pope Benedict XIV. And his book is still used. And because, as he wrote it as Prospero Lambertini, the criteria that he laid out for what a medical miracle needs to be like are sometimes called the Lambertini criteria. And they include things like in conjunction with the request for the intercession of a saint or proposed saint, the healing must occur really fast. You know, it's not something like, well, it gradually got better over time. It must be a complete healing. It must be a lasting healing. It's not like it reverts. There must be no medical explanation and so forth. So if these criteria are found to have been met in the case of a particular miracle, there's then a theological consultation that looks at the purported miracle from a theological point of view and says, you know, okay, so you're claiming this was in regard to the intercession of proposed Saint, you know, John Smith. Let's document that. And do we have good evidence that this miracle is actually tied to the intercession of proposed Saint John Smith? And then if the theological consultation signs off on it, the case is forwarded to the congregation, to these days the dicastery for the causes of saints as a whole, which is led by a group of cardinals. It's overseen by a group of cardinals, and they may end up certifying the miracle. So that's the overall process. It starts with a scientific look. And then only if the scientific aspect of the case is rigorously verified does it go for further theological consideration. So they don't grant certification to miracles easily. They're really strict about it. If there's any doubt about, you know, could it have been something else, then they just don't pass judgment on it.
In that case, I suppose it could have been a miracle, but it's not something that we can propose to people as a miracle because there's other options.
Yeah, like let's say someone goes to the healing spring at Lourdes in France and they've got some chronic condition, and afterwards their condition does get better, but it's like 50% better and not 100% better, mm-hmm. and it takes several months for that to happen after they visit Lourdes. Well, we're not saying God's hand wasn't at work in that. It's just not the full dramatic, you know, mm-hmm. really hard to explain miracle that it would be approved for a canonization purpose.
Well, I appreciate you taking my question, Jimmy. There's lots of folks on the line, so we will take a very quick break, and then we'll come back and we'll just have Ask Me Anything with Jimmy Akin for a nice, fun Friday afternoon on Catholic Answers Live.
Catch Catholic Answers Live anytime at Catholic.com.
Are you a coffee drinker? If so, you can now enjoy a coffee roasted to perfection by the Carmelite Monks of Wyoming. Delicious Mystic Monk coffee is roasted and prepared by monks in a hidden cloistered monastery and is available in over 25 varieties. All Mystic Monk coffees are works of perfection and labors of love. For more information on how to purchase Mystic Monk coffee, visit mysticmonkcoffee.com. That's mysticmonkcoffee.com.
The most original Catholic content is on EWTN Radio.
On Mother Angelica Answering the Call, Father Joseph and Doug Keck mine decades of phone calls answered by Mother Angelica. No subject is off limits and no problem too big for the wisdom and compassion of the one and only Mother Angelica.
Mother Angelica Answering the Call, Sunday afternoon, 2 Eastern, on EWTN Radio.
Back, Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kellett, your host. Jimmy Akin is our guest, and it's Ask Me Anything. You can ask Jimmy whatever you like. And our first question actually has already been submitted to us anonymously. And so, Jimmy, I'll just read the question to you. Our anonymous questioner wants to know this. I have a lot of Protestant friends who ask me a lot about Mary. I am curious now, why do we venerate Mary at all? If she was born without original sin, how can she be good? She didn't have the option to be sinful because she was born without sin. So shouldn't we venerate saints to a higher degree than her? because they had the choice to be sinful and they didn't, which seems like that makes them even better than her. Also, I was told by a Catholic that God loves Mary more than any other human he created. Is that true?
Okay, so by the way, Cy, very dramatic read in there. I'm not sure it's the one intended by Anonymous, who just said that they're curious, not that they're irate.
I'm recovering from a cold, Jimmy. Okay. I had to give it my full power to get through it.
We'll cut you slack then. Okay, so let's deal with the first part of the question. Why would we venerate Mary, given that she was sinless? Well, in the first place, she's a mother of Jesus, and that makes her worthy of significant respect. Also, she herself says in Luke chapter 2, behold, all generations are going to call me blessed. So she foresees that. Now, we can then ask a question of beyond the fact that she was Jesus's mother, and beyond the fact that she prophesied that that she would be recognized as blessed by future generations, why else would we want to venerate her in connection with her personal goodness? Well, personal goodness is a reason to venerate someone. You know, if someone displays holiness, they're worthy of respect or veneration. But what Anonymous is asking is presupposing is that Mary didn't have a choice about this. And that is not church teaching. That's an opinion. What the church teaches is that Mary was free from all stain of original sin from the moment of her conception. And that includes not only original sin, but actual sin, which is part of the stain of original sin. But that's different than saying Mary could not sin. What could not sin, the term for could not sin is impeccable, from the Latin word peccare, meaning sin. So someone's impeccable if they can't sin. But the church teaches Mary was immaculately conceived and remained immaculate or stainless, not that she was unable to sin or impeccable. You could hold the opinion that she was impeccable, but that's not church teaching. That's just an opinion. And so on that view, if Mary was not impeccable, then she used her freedom, which could have chosen evil or good, to always choose good. And that's a meritorious act. So you would want to venerate her for that reason. On the other hand, suppose that she was impeccable. Well, just because you don't have the ability to choose sin doesn't mean you lack free will. You know, in heaven, we're going to only be choosing good. We won't be able to sin, but that doesn't mean we're not going to have free will. We're not going to be like programmed robots up in heaven. God's not going to reach into our mind and yank out the free will he gave us. So what we'll have, my opinion would be, is the freedom to choose different goods. And Mary chose good, even if she only had good options to choose from because of the way her will was configured, she still could choose greater goods in preference to lesser goods, like the greater good she chose of being Jesus's mom. Because when Gabriel says, hey, guess what? You're going to be the mother of the Son of God. She says, be it done unto me according to your word. She consents to that great good and to play in that role, even though it's going to mean she's going to have suffering in life. Because as she's told shortly after Jesus is born, a sword will pierce her own heart also. So because she made these choices, including the free choice to become Jesus's mom, the alternative to that, whatever it might have been, would not have been a sin, just to say no thanks. But she freely chose to do this great good. And so that is another reason to venerate her, even if she was impeccable. So that's the first question. Then there's the second question about, I was also told by a Catholic that God loves Mary more than any other human he created. Is this true? This is one that, as far as I'm aware, the church doesn't have any teaching on this. This would be another opinion. But who would hold this opinion is going to be partially influenced by the theory of love that they have. Now, one of the things we know about God is he doesn't have emotions the way we do. He doesn't have like when we get angry, you know, we feel this burning physical sensation. And God doesn't have that, you know, because he doesn't have a body apart from the incarnation. So God also is outside of time, and emotions are changing things. And the whole situation of how God's emotion, what we would think of as emotions work, is really complex. And it's more than I can really get into here. But we do know that God can be described as having love because, you know, 1 John says God is love. So he has something that corresponds to love. But the question is, what is that? Well, one theory, and this is just a theory, this is not church teaching, but one theory about how God's love works was endorsed by St. Thomas Aquinas. And he was of the opinion that our love works this way. We see something good about somebody, and we're attracted to that. We love that about them. So we have a kind of attraction-based love. On the other hand, well, what if you're God, you know, and you give a creature its qualities? Well, then there is no love in that creature. There's nothing lovable in that creature until you give them the lovable quality. So Aquinas proposed that the way God's love works is when we say God loves somebody, person X, what that means is God gives person X a lovable quality. And so if you adopt the Thomistic opinion about how God's love works, could you say that God, in that sense, loves Mary more than any other human? Well, Mary was the mother of Jesus, and she was uniquely, immaculately conceived, and so those are both good qualities that no other humans have. So it seems to me there would be a case for saying that in the Thomistic sense, God loves Mary more than any other human because he gave her greater blessings than he gave any other human. He made her more lovable by giving her these qualities. On the other hand, the Thomistic opinion on how God's love works is just an opinion. And there could be other ways of thinking about it besides the one that Thomas proposed. So I wouldn't say that this is definitely unarguable. But I can see how, at least under that opinion, there would be a case for making that argument, since God gave Mary unique, lovable things that he didn't give to everybody.
All right, Anonymous, I hope that
I should mention, there's also a sense in which God loves everybody equally, because, and this is underscored in the New Testament in various passages, because since God gives us whatever good qualities we have, God also takes that into account when he judges us. So if you have lots of good qualities, you're going to be judged by a stricter standard than if you have few. As Jesus himself said, to whom much is given, much is expected. So not only would God love Mary in a great way because of the unique blessings he gave her, he's also going to hold her accountable in an even greater way than other people are going to held accountable. So there's a fundamental fairness. And in that sense, God loves everybody equally. If he gives you great things, he'll expect great things from you. If he only gives you modest things, he'll only expect modest things from you. And he'll be pleased either way, as long as you do what you're supposed to with what he's given you.
Again, Anonymous, thank you. Thank you very much. I think we've got time, so we'll head to the phones before we have to take a break. Tom's in Omaha, Nebraska, listening on Spirit Catholic Radio. Hi, Tom. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Thank you. Here's my question on the Orthodox Holy Saturday, or whatever they call it, at Jerusalem, at the Tomb of the Holy Sepulchre. They have this, what they claim is this miraculous fire
starts the tomb of Christ.
Mm-hmm. Right.
In the tomb of Christ,
What do you think about that? Do you think that's today we have St. Januarius, and the blood has liquefied for 1,600 years or something. What do you think about that fire?
Well, so I haven't studied the St. Januarius reported miracle in detail, so I'm not going to comment on that. But I have studied the Holy Fire one in a lot of detail. In fact, I have an episode of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World that is all about it. It's episode 293. So I know the break's going to interrupt in a minute, but you can find that episode by going to mysterious.fm/293, and you can watch the whole episode for yourself. But here's the thing. It is claimed by many ordinary, pious, Orthodox people that when their patriarch goes into the tomb on Holy Saturday, along with another Eastern patriarch, they come out and they've had, there's the break. I'll finish on the other side.
All right, Tom, hang on. Thank you for the call. We'll get our answer to the Holy Fire in the Holy Land right after this on Catholic Answers Live. If you've got a question, I'm looking at one line open right now, 888-318-7884.
We hope that one of the things that we communicate here at Catholic Answers Live is that our Catholic faith allows us to be fully serious about all the problems we encounter in the church and in the world, but it also lets us have light hearts and maybe even mix in a bit of fun, and that is exactly what our good friend Joe Heschmeyer does in his popular podcast, Shameless Popery. You should check it out at shamelessjoe.com. Joe's got a deep grasp of the faith, of morals, the teachings of the church, all that, but he's also got a witty conversational style. He entertains and he informs, but you will leave equipped to better answer the most common challenges, misconceptions, and questions about the Catholic faith. He's got insightful guests, he does on-air debates, and he takes a close look into all the things that you want to know about as a Catholic living today. You'll walk away knowledgeable and filled with joy. Look for Joe on his YouTube channel. Check him out at shamelessjoe.com or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like what you hear, become a patron.
Throughout history, some Catholics have been among the worst kind of villains, right? Or were they? In Canceled, historian Steve Weidenkopf digs into the lives and controversies of some of these Catholics whose reputations have been blackened, often unfairly. He takes on the anti-Catholic versions of history and defends not only these figures, but the faith they represent. Order your copy of Canceled today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
When the resurrected Jesus appeared to disciples on the road to Emmaus, they didn't recognize him until the breaking of the bread. The same is true today. In the Holy Eucharist, we really meet Jesus. In The Eucharist is Really Jesus, author Joe Heschmeyer explains how knowing Jesus in the Eucharist is the key to understanding all of Christian faith. Order your copy of The Eucharist is Really Jesus today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin, our guest, and it's Ask Me Anything, which people ask for. They're like, will you do an Ask Me Anything with Jimmy Akin? So you can ask anything, because other people asked if we would do an Ask Me Anything. And on the line is Tom in Omaha, Nebraska, who wants to know, is there really a miracle of the Holy Fire at the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem, Jimmy?
Yeah, so now people should be aware that Church of the Holy Sepulchre is not under the control of a single group of Christians. It's actually, there are like six different groups of Christians. One of them is the Franciscan friars who represent the Catholic Church, but the other five are Eastern Christians of different types. So on Holy Saturday, one of the Eastern officials goes into the tomb along with a second Eastern official from a different Eastern communion. And while they're in there, a flame is lit, and then they come out and they share this flame with the pilgrims who are surrounding the church, who are surrounding the Holy Sepulchre itself in the church. And then they pass it around, and sometimes they take this flame, they put it on airplanes. They have special containers for it, and they put it on airplanes and take it to different parts of the Christian world, and it's a very beautiful, moving ceremony. But many in the Orthodox community claim that the flame lights miraculously, that the official who brings it out does not do anything to cause this flame to light. Instead, God just lights it. And they even have stories about how this, you know, flaming light comes from the rock that covers, you know, the part of the tomb where they lay Jesus, and it lights the material he has in there. So there are these claims about it, but the relevant Orthodox bodies do not make these claims. If you like go to the patriarchal website and read it in Greek, it does not make these claims. So this is kind of folk orthodoxy rather than official teaching. And I'm very open to miracles of all different kinds. I'm a little suspicious of a miracle that occurs like clockwork every single time on the same day of the year. But that wouldn't stop me if we had good evidence for this. But in the process of research in episode 293 of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, I got material, including an interview with the other official who goes in there, with the official who brings out the light, who says, yeah, it's just natural. There's another lamp in there, and they use that other lamp to light it. So it's not a miracle. And even the officials who do bring it out have been more forthcoming in recent years about saying that, yeah, it's not really a miracle. This news has not gone over well with some in the different Orthodox communities who want to regard it as a miracle. But even though we have eyewitness testimony saying this is not miraculous, that doesn't stop it from being a beautiful and meaningful ceremony about how the light of Christ pervades the world, coming from his very tomb where he was resurrected.
Tom, I'm going to say thanks. I hope that was a helpful answer to you. Lots of folks on the line that's asked me anything. Jimmy Akin, our guest. Philip is in Lubbock, Texas, listening on Catholic.com. Welcome, Philip. Go ahead with your question. Hi, Philip. All right, we're going to come back to you, Philip. Now I'm going to have to put up the sign, Lord of the Buttons. Philip, I pushed the wrong button. I apologize.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can now because I pushed the right button.
Okay, great. My question is about convalidation of a marriage. My wife and I have been married for 49 years. Mm-hmm. We've been Protestant the whole time. We've never been divorced. Our only marriage is to each other now for 49 mm-hmm. years. I am currently an OCIA. I plan on being received into the church at the Easter Vigil. My wife is not an OCIA right now, and doesn't have plans to come to the church at this time. So my question is: does our marriage have to be convalidated before I can be received into the church? I don't think it does, but I want to verify.
Yeah, based on the fact pattern you described, no. The two of you were married as non-Catholics 49 years ago. Neither of you had been married to anybody else. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay. So not being Catholics, you don't, at the time of your marriage, you didn't need to observe Catholic marriage law. So the church would presume that your marriage is valid, and thus you would not need to have the marriage convalidated in order to join the church, because you're already in a valid marriage.
Correct. Yep.
Yep.
All right. That's what I thought, but I wanted to verify.
Well, yep. I am delighted to hear about you coming into the Catholic Church. Is there a book of ours that we might send you just as an encouragement and as a kind of, you know, just a little gift we could give you? You want time to think about it? I can put you on with Edgar.
Yeah, that might be good.
Okay, hang on, because we got a lot of Catholic Answers books. If you'd like one, we'd be happy to send it to you, help you along your journey, we hope. The number here is 888-318-7884. It's Ask Me Anything. Jimmy Akin is our guest. And if you call, I will do my very best to push the right button to get you on the air. Jonathan's up in my town, Oceanside, California, listening on Catholic.com. Hey, Jonathan.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Happy to.
Now, this is a question that's been on my mind for a while. Last year and the year before, I attended a Renaissance fair with a friend, and within a day to a week afterwards, I was hospitalized each time. My question is it un-Catholic? Does it fall into the realm of superstition for me to be concerned or afraid of going back out of fear that I might be hospitalized again? And as a kind of a follow-up, is there anything supernatural to this, or is it all just a coincidence?
Well, okay, so the presumption with anything like this is it's going to be pure. If there is a causal connection between going to a Renaissance fair and getting hospitalized, the presumption would be that whatever is going on here, if anything is going on here, would be natural, not supernatural. Because natural phenomena are more common than supernatural phenomena. And in this case, you only have two instances of this pattern happening. And in a scientific experiment, they express the number of trials in an experiment with using the variable n for number. And here, n equals 2. And with almost any experiment you run, if n equals 2, your experiment is seriously, seriously underpowered. So you just don't have enough data to claim any kind of supernatural connection here. In fact, you don't even have enough data to claim any kind of natural connection unless there's more to the story than you've mentioned, which is something I'll get to in a minute. But if all you have is this happened to me twice, that can just be coincidence. So let's look a little further and say, well, were you hospitalized? I'm going to try to, you know, no one knows who you are anyway, but I'm going to try to be delicate here for your privacy. Were you hospitalized for the same thing both times?
Yes, I was.
And have you ever been hospitalized for that thing outside of going to a Renaissance fair?
I never have been.
Have you otherwise suffered from that thing apart from going to a Renaissance fair?
I have not.
Really? Okay. Is there any connection between what happened to you at the Renaissance Fair that could have led in a natural way to this hospitalization? Like, did you eat certain foods and have an allergic reaction? Or did you play, you know, get dunked in the water and twisted your ankle or something like that?
None of the above, actually.
Okay. Well, in that case, could you, in a way that you're comfortable with, describe for me what it was that you were hospitalized for?
No, I don't mind at all. I was hospitalized for a collapsed lung, and both times it was the same lung.
Okay. And what did they diagnose as the cause of the collapsed lung when you went to the hospital?
They just said it was spontaneous, since I was not injured or have no history of chest injury.
And had you done anything strenuous in going to the Renaissance Fair?
Not at all.
Okay. Well, based on the facts you've described, I would say that you know, it sounds like a coincidence. I mean, that would be the presumption. It just happened to be something that occurred after going to a Renaissance fair. This is not a a phenomenon that is commonly reported. If people go to a Renaissance fair and just take in the sights and stuff and have some allegedly medieval snacks, that doesn't tend to lead to collapsed lungs, whether either through natural causation or non-natural causation. And since it's only happened twice, my assumption would be that it's just coincidence. Having said that, as to your question about would it be superstitious, well, superstition is believing in something too much, attributing more significance to something than it actually has. And so in this case, I would say, based on my read of the data, that, yeah, it could be superstitious to say, you know, something paranormal happened here and or even something natural happened here. Just based on a sample size of two, I understand how it can be freaky, but it also just sounds like a freaky coincidence, which is what coincidences are. They're freaky. So I would say there is the potential for being superstitious here. On the other hand, that doesn't mean you got to go to the Renaissance fair. If you want to say, you know, I went and I'm just kind of nervous about going again, even if it's not rational, I'm just kind of nervous. Well, then don't go. But I wouldn't be concluding that there was anything more than a coincidence here, because I'm not seeing evidence for anything more than coincidence, at least at this point. Now, if you keep going, and you know, you go say another 3 years, and each time you get hospitalized for a collapsed lung afterwards, well, then I'd say, okay, something's going on here. It may be purely natural. There may be some effect that going has that, you know, hasn't been identified. It even hypothetically, it could be supernatural, but we don't have any evidence for that. So it sounds to me right now like this is just coincidence. Now, I mentioned if you're nervous and you don't want to go, you don't have to, but there also can be a benefit to going again, namely to disprove to yourself that there's anything to worry about. If you go a third time and you don't end up in the hospital with a collapsed lung, well, then you can say, oh, I guess it was just a coincidence because it didn't happen this time. So, you know, I would say sometimes facing your fear is the way to go. And you could always just say, you know, say a quick prayer, go and see if it happens again. And if it doesn't, then that just shows you don't have anything to worry about. And you could keep going to this or some other Renaissance fair for years into the future if it's something you enjoy.
Okay, Jonathan.
Yeah, I really appreciate that. That really clarifies a lot for me.
Great.
Awesome.
Thank you very much for the call. And if you do go, enjoy the giant turkey leg. We got to take a very quick break. Then we'll be right back with more Ask Me Anything with Jimmy Akin. And I'll tell you what happened in the last few minutes. Three lines opened up. So if you've got a question for Jimmy Akin, this is your opportunity. 888-318-7884.
This is Archbishop Paul Coakley, the Archdiocese of Oklahoma City. And you're listening to Catholic Answers Live.
Who was the first Catholic in your family? Were they evangelized by a friend, a coworker, a stranger? Did you ever think that you could be that person that God uses to save a soul? And that soul could save their family, their grandchildren, and generations to come? At St. Paul Street Evangelization, a Catholic nonprofit, we train, equip, and mobilize Catholic disciples to do the urgent work of evangelization. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization, streetevangelization.com.
EWTN offers the Holy Sacrifice of the Mass live every morning at 8 Eastern and provides you with daily readings to follow along and enrich your experience. To be sure you don't miss out on the daily Mass or to get access to previous recordings, we can send a link to your email inbox every day. It's easy. Visit EWTN.com and click subscribe. EWTN, the Global Catholic Network.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin, our guest. I am Cy Kellett, your host. Clearly, I have a problem. As a person mentions a Renaissance fair, and I'm just like fried dough. I just start thinking about fried dough. So that's me, though. That's my problems. We don't need to dwell on those. Ryan is in Midland, Texas, listening on the Catholic Answers app. Mm. Welcome, Ryan. Go ahead.
Hey, Jimmy, I wanted to ask you, I was listening to your Ascension of Isaiah episode of Mysterious World, and I've been wondering, since that text uses the names Samael and Belial as names for the devil, I was curious, how did Lucifer become like a convoluted catch-all name for the devil when, historically speaking, the Bible doesn't use the name Lucifer as a name for the devil anywhere?
Okay, well, it doesn't. Well, you're right, it doesn't. And in fact, the word Lucifer doesn't even appear in an English translation of the Bible. Lucifer is a Latin word. It means light bringer or light bearer. And it's the name, the ancient Roman name for the planet Venus, because Venus, now the phrases that we use in English to refer to Venus without using its name that we at least sometimes use are the evening star and the morning star. And the thing is, Venus is closer to the sun than Earth is. And so Venus always appears near the sun in the sky. And it's also very bright. And so when the sun goes down in the evening, one of the first stars you notice is actually Venus, because it's bright and it's near where the sun goes down. So you see it even standing out against the background glow of the sun, even if the sun's below the horizon. And so it came to be known as the evening star because it would appear in the evening. Well, guess what? Same thing happens 12 hours later when the sun comes up in the morning. When the sun comes up in the morning, Venus is going to be near it and it's going to be really bright. And so it's going to be one of the last stars to fade out in daytime. And so it's also called the morning star. In Greek, the morning star. In Greek, the terms for the evening star and the morning star were Hesperus, that's the evening star, and Phosphorus, that's the morning star. But in Latin, the morning star was called Lucifer, or from lux, meaning light. And so Lucifer, that fur ending, means bringer or carrier or someone who does something. And so Lucifer, meant the morning star, the light bringing star. When you see the morning star just above the horizon, that means the sun's about to come up there. So that means that we can find references to this planet in Scripture. The term is sometimes used. The Hebrew word for the morning star is Hillel, and it appears in Isaiah 14:2. Isaiah 14:2 is a passage that does not actually have to do with the devil, but it is a lament where the fall of a great leader is being celebrated. And it says, how you are fallen from heaven, O morning stars, O Hillel in Hebrew, son of the morning, how you are cut down to the ground, which did weaken the nation. So you have this great leader of men that has now fallen from prominence. And to highlight how high his former position was and how he kind of conceitedly thought of himself, he thought, I'm like the morning star, that's how important I am. But no, he's been brought down low. And so the prophet Isaiah refers to him as Hillel, which got translated in Jerome's Vulgate as Lucifer. Now, this passage is actually not talking about the devil, but because, not in the literal sense of the text, but because the devil is a important fallen angel, it got applied to the devil by Christians. And so in the Christian imagination, the name Lucifer became associated with Satan. And that's where, that's how the name came to be, even though really Lucifer just means light bringer, and it's another name for the planet Venus.
All right.
That's very fascinating. So, Jimmy, if someone tries to explain to me that Lucifer is another name for the devil, do I just tell them that they're wrong, or just simply cite what you just told me?
Well, you could keep your mouth shut. You don't have to correct them. Not everything everybody says is something we need to correct. Or if it's worth going into it, you could tell them what I just mentioned. But that may lead to a longer discussion about, so exactly what does Isaiah mean and how do we know this and so forth. And they may or may not be willing to listen to you. It's all a judgment call about what do you think is going to be productive with this person in this conversation I'm having. By the way, one thing to be aware of, if someone's hung up on the name Lucifer, is the fact that Jesus is also called the Morning Star in the New Testament. So it's clear that the term Lightbringer or Morning Star or Lucifer does not refer exclusively to the devil. It can also refer to other people, including Jesus himself. He is the Lightbringer for our souls.
Thanks. I'm going to keep going, Ryan. Try to get another call in before we have to take a little quick break at the end of this hour. Amy's in Ohio listening on the Catholic Answers app.
By the way, that reference for where Jesus is called the Morning Star is Revelation 22:16.
All right. And we'll hear that again at Christmas. It always comes up at Christmas time. Questions about that. Amy in Ohio, go ahead with your question.
Hello. I am a registered nurse. And I take care of moms and babies as a lactation consultant. And mm-hmm. I have been partaking in cranial sacral therapy classes. And mm-hmm. it seems like the online sources say that I should not do that if I am a Catholic.
Why?
So I'm just curious. It seems to say that it's because it works with energy that it could be superstitious, is how I understand it. But I don't feel that way. Like when I'm learning it, I'm learning about fascia and muscles and, you know, the nervous system and such. But I just feel like I should ask. It's okay.
I'm sorry. You're cutting out there.
Oh.
Just run.
Can you hear me?
Yeah. Could you just run through it again about why you feel this is not a thing for a Catholic to be involved in?
Well, online, it compares it to Reiki or Reiki, and it says that it's not completely scientific yet. And some of my coworkers who are Christian, not necessarily Catholic, they say that they don't feel comfortable learning it because of those reasons.
Okay, so let me, I heard you mention before you cut out some energy being involved in this. Have they been telling you to do anything with energy in these classes?
No.
No? Okay, well, I'm not surprised because to my understanding, craniosacral therapy is basically a kind of massage. And I've got a webpage I pulled up from the Cleveland Clinic that says right at the top, craniosacral therapy is a gentle hands-on massaging technique. It uses a light touch to release tension around your body's connective tissue network called the fascia. CST promotes pain mm-hmm. relief from headaches, neck pains, and the side effects of cancer treatment. Okay. There's nothing in this about moving energy around or energy healing or anything like that. Even if there were, that would just be something unproven. That doesn't make it wrong. It just means it's unproven. Like in acupuncture, where according to classical acupuncture, there are channels in the body that involve some kind of energy flow. And we have no evidence from science of that happening. But even if there is no such energy, that doesn't mean the effect can't be therapeutic. Well, here, we don't even have any kind of energy being discussed. So I would say if you want to learn different kinds of massage therapy, including craniosacral therapy, to help people out, go for it. There's nothing here contrary to church teaching, at least not that I have discovered. If someone wants to cite something specific and argue that it violates church teaching, show it to me. I'd love to look at it, but I don't see anything here along those lines. And I would say that people who make unfounded charges like this are committing sort of the inverse of superstition. They're being superstitious in the wrong direction. Well, in fact, depending on how you frame it, they are being superstitious. They're attributing too much significance to this practice by attributing a forbidden significance that doesn't even exist, and that can harm people getting the therapy they need. So I'd say, to me, this all looks fine. If someone wants to argue with that, I'm happy to talk to them, but this looks fine to me.
Hey, Amy, you can hear the music. That means we got to go to the break, but God bless you in your work as a nurse. And if you'd like, I'll be happy to send you a copy of Jimmy's book, A Daily Defense. He's got a whole bunch of questions and answers in there about the faith, and I'd love it if you'd that you would have it if you want it. Just hang on the line and Edgar will get your information if that is the case. Say, where there's two lines open, soon to be three lines open, and it's Ask Me Anything with Jimmy Akin. If you've got a question, whether you're Catholic or not, whether you're religious of any kind or not, 888-318-7884.